You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. Today we're looking at the book The Mind of the CEO by Jeffrey E. Garten. Introduction. Suppose you had the chance to travel around the world and speak to dozens of the most successful business leaders, one on one. Suppose further that they talk to you frankly about their goals and strategies and what keeps them awake at night. What would you think about these captains of industry who sell trillions of dollars worth of products and services, employ many millions of people, and develop our path-breaking technologies? Would you find them impressive or ordinary? Would you judge their visions bold enough for the changing times? What kind of impact do you think they would have on shaping society in the early 21st century? What kind of impact do you think they should have? In late 1999, I had this very experience. I interviewed 40 men and women whose jobs and ideas affect just about every part of our lives. I tried to get into these people's heads. I wanted to understand the environment in which they were operating, the opportunities they saw, the obstacles they face, and what worried them the most. I wanted to know what they thought about the challenges posed by the internet, the new economy, the management of gigantic corporations spanning many national cultures, and what role they saw for themselves in building the foundations of capitalism in our times. When I was done, I tried to come to grips with what I thought was the environment CEOs faced, how they were dealing with it, and what more, if anything, they ought to be doing. In other words, how they could prepare their corporations for the future. Jack Welch, chairman and CEO of General Electric, held forth an audience of MBA students at Yale recently. I was in the audience, and that's when the idea for this book arose. Welch, of course, is one of the most successful business leaders of our times, having taken GE from a market value of $12 billion to over $500 billion in his 20 years at the company's helm, and having set the standard for other CEOs on corporate restructuring, quality control, globalization, and how to take a traditional industrial and service company into the internet age. The room was packed. Students were sitting on the floor in front of the first row of seats in the aisles and cramming the doorway. And yet the audience seemed totally motionless in its concentration on what Welch was saying. When he finished speaking, he asked if there were any questions, and at least 25 hands shot up immediately. He pointed out one eager young man. "Shoot," he said. "Lots of companies are merging these days," said the student. "If I found myself in charge of one of these big new conglomerates, What would be your advice to me? Welsh took off his coat and threw it on the chair behind him. He walked in front of the podium, rolling up his shirt sleeves at the same time. You have to think about that company as being a big house, he said. The house has several floors. Think of each floor as a layer of management. Then their interior walls. Think of them as separating different divisions of the company. His eyes were glistening and he moved closer to the audience. Then you get a hand grenade, he said, his arm curling upwards and his fist tightening around an imaginary object. And then you pull the pin. He paused. It seemed as if all the students were leaning forward. And then, now he dropped his shoulder, stooped, and slowly swung his arm in a long arc as if he were bowling. And you roll the sucker right down through the front door of the house and you blow up every floor and every wall. He straightened up, smoothed one hand against the other. And now you're ready to do something with that company. America's legendary CEO went on to explain that his strategy for GE was to create an organization without any boundaries, a culture in which ideas flowed freely from the division that made aircraft parts to one that made light bulbs, from the subsidiary in Shanghai to the one in Cincinnati. But first, he said, you had to tear down the existing barriers. Tearing down barriers is the heart of Welsh's strategy for GE. But the idea resonates nearly everywhere. It describes what is happening within companies of every industry as hierarchies are flattened. Barriers to internal communication are removed and employees become more entrepreneurial. It reflects what is going on among the corporations as they join forces in all kinds of partnerships to expand their range of products and customers. It is a metaphor for what the internet is doing around the world. It is the essence of the blurring of national borders, the phenomena we call globalization. Jack Welsh is one of the many top business executives who has come from the, quote, Leaders Forum, unquote, at the Yale School of Management to tell their stories. Another is St. John Brown, chief executive of British Petroleum, who over the past 4 years has acquired two large American firms, Amoco and Atlantic Richfield, and thus has become a pioneer in the creation of the new transatlantic megafirms. Brown also came to Yale in the fall of 1998 to talk about how leadership entails not just focusing on the bottom line, but also on the relationship between a company and the communities in which it operates. In his talk, he committed BP to voluntarily reduce carbon emissions below levels recommended by governments or targeted by other firms, a groundbreaking announcement that was instantly reported around the world. When he finished, a student posed a broader question. How do you think about the links between big multinational firms like yours and society at large? Brown slowly walked up the central aisle, about 20 yards up, and stood right next to the student. He spoke so softly that the small portable microphone hooked to his tie barely picked up his words. Quote, companies are an integral part of the societies in which they work, he said with unmistakable earnestness. We don't make profits, and then we go live somewhere else. This is our society, too. The people who make up our company are also citizens. They have hopes and fears for themselves and for their families. Companies that want to keep operating successfully have to uphold their employees' values, just like their customers' values. They can't isolate themselves. They have to be engaged in public policy issues. They have to be constructive. Brown's words illuminate another vital issue. In a global economy where Adam Smith has decisively won the day and where governments have far less control over economic and technological forces than at any other time in memory, what are the roles and responsibilities of big international companies? How should we think about the relationship between their mission to enrich their shareholders and their obligations to other groups such as customers, employees, suppliers, and communities in which they work? These questions raise other questions. Just how much power do leaders like Welsh and Brown have at the dawn of the new century? What opportunities do they see? And what constraints? How do they define their biggest challenges? And what should we think of their perspective on these challenges? Listening to Welsh, Brown, and many others who come to Yale, I found myself wanting to talk more intimately with some of them and with more of them who had yet to make it there to find out what was on their minds. Top executives of global companies lead organizations with enormous reach. Among the people I interviewed, for example, Stephen Case, chairman and CEO of America Online, will, once the merger with Time Warner is complete, sit on top of one of the world's largest communications conglomerates, which has at least 22 million internet subscribers and reaches some 65 million households via sales of books and magazines. See Michael Armstrong, who runs AT&T, directs a company with over 60 million customers. William Clay Ford, Jr., Ford's Motor Company's, has sales that exceed the gross national product of many countries. Leonard Riggio's Barnes and Noble's accounts for about 10% of all the books sold in the United States. Jorma Olia Nokia constitutes over half of the stock market capitalization in Finland, its home base, as well as 25% of all global sales of cellular phones. Sir Market Sorrells, WPP, which is acquiring Young and Rubicam, is about to become the world's largest advertising and communications conglomerate. Robert Murdoch's News Corporation beams news, sports, and entertainment from Boston to Beijing, and is becoming the most formidable media company in the United States. Henry Paulson Jr., Goldman Sachs, advises some of the world's largest firms regarding their structures and strategies, and accounted for 20% of all the money raised for initial public offerings in the United States in 1999. Rolf E. Brewers, Deutsche's bank, is the largest bank in Europe, depending on how you measure it, in the world. George Soros, the world's best-known global investor, has moved international markets with his business decisions or his public policy suggestions. Susan Berry's Ford's Ford Foundation supports philanthropic causes through offices in 16 countries. CEOs are also major actors in the drama called globalization. Their companies move money, information, goods, and services that are knitting the world together. They therefore have a crucial impact on economic growth, employment, technological development, and the environment. They will influence values relating to the balance of private and public interest, how much free market and how much regulation, for example. They will guide the socially explosive activities that fall at the intersection of science and technology, commerce and values. Biomedical research, genetically modified foods, privacy, and personal security. They can be a progressive force in building capitalism around the world, or they can constitute a rear guard action against political and economic change. However they behave, their influence will be at least as important as that of national governments and international institutions, probably in many cases more so. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you're listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenary. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
Every year, countless people succumb to the temptation to purchase exotic animals like hedgehogs, lizards, monkeys, even tigers and bears to keep as pets. But life in captivity is often a death sentence for these animals, who may suffer from malnutrition, an improper environment, and the stress of confinement. For more information on this issue, visit the BCSPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF, 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenari, professional futurist. Welcome back. We are looking at the book The Mind of the CEO by Jeffrey E. Garton. We're still in the introduction, looking at international CEOs, what makes them leaders. I talk to leaders here and abroad from a wide range of industries, including telecommunications, computers, automobiles, aviation, energy, finance, law, healthcare, media and entertainment, publishing, advertising, consumer products, economic development, and philanthropy. I spoke not just to people who ran global companies, but also to those who financed and advised them. I looked for men and women who were highly respected by their peers and recognizable to a large audience, while deliberately excluding the new breed of successful dot-com entrepreneurs. I did not ignore the enormous wave of entrepreneurship around the world. My sample included some who founded major operations and continue to run them, including Frederick Smith, Rupert Murdoch, Michael Dell, Stephen Case, Michael Bloomberg, Leonard Riggio, and Richard Branson. I also selected leaders who were exceptionally innovative in large organizations, adapting technology, decentralizing decision-making, stimulating new ideas throughout their organizations, and motivating their employees to be more creative. I went to prominent venture capitalism and capitalists to get their views. Donald Valentine at Sequoia Capital, Leonard Baker at Sutter Hill Ventures, Nancy Peretzman at Allen & Company. I spent time with Ira Milstein, who leads Veal, Gottschall, and Manges, a prominent U.S. law firm, and has been an advisor to various presidents, governors, and international institutions. To gain some historical perspective, I spoke also to three influential historians, Ron Chernow, the biographer of J.P. Morgan, and John D. Rockefeller, Richard Tedlow, a business historian at Harvard Business School, and Emma Rothschild, an economic historian from Cambridge University in England. In making my selections, I knew I was not talking to the typical CEO. These men and women in this book are the top of the pyramid. From the resources they oversee to the pressures they face, they constitute an elite class, a distinct group worthy of observing. I am also aware that generalizing about leaders who are involved in a range of industries requires omitting a large number of important concerns that relate to specific companies. An investment bank faces different day-to-day opportunities than an automobile company. Nevertheless, there is no shortage of information on individual executives and their firms, and I want to compliment what exists elsewhere by focusing on what they have in common. A media company and a high-tech manufacturer are both preoccupied with the internet, globalization, getting closer to customers, figuring out how to tap into exceptional talent around the world. This book, therefore, does not attempt to cover all the important questions surrounding CEOs, or even most of them, but rather looks at business leadership throughout a wide-angle lens. As a business school dean, I know as well the extent of scholarly research that exists on all aspects of business management. I've come to respect this work enormously. and a good deal of my professional time is devoted to creating an environment where it is encouraged and promoted. But as someone who spent most of his life on Wall Street and in Washington, I lay no claim to scholarly knowledge in this area. This is not a theoretical book, and there is no pretense that it is based on hard analytical data. To the extent that it provides insights into business strategy, it is the result of what CEOs are saying to me and the thoughts they provoke. My objective has been to reflect on the most important thoughts that run through the minds of some of the world's leaders as a group. I was looking for patterns for which to draw conclusions, patterns derived from what was said and what wasn't. Most important, I make no pretense of being an objective observer. Although I drew from interviews, I wanted to describe not just what the world's top corporate executives are saying, but what it made me think about. I have been interacting with top business leaders throughout my career. When I was on Wall Street, some were my clients. When I was Under Secretary of Commerce, I helped many of them to expand their company presence abroad. As a columnist at Business Week, I write about them. As a dean, I now call on some of them to help educate our students. In this book, I want to talk about the awesome challenges that CEOs faced as seen, though what they have said to me and as filtered through my own experience and my own thoughts. Finally, let me explain how I went through about writing this book and how it is organized. When I began this project, I had no preconceived view of how it would turn out. In effect, I conducted an experiment by talking to top business people to see what they thought. Because the interviews, which averaged 60 to 90 minutes each, covered a wide range of topics, many ideas arose. I subsequently zeroed in on those few themes that emerged most frequently and that I felt were the most fundamental to CEOs' thinking. As I sat down to write, in some cases I felt as though it was enough for me to just be an observer. In other times, I wanted to comment. In yet others, I felt compelled to go further and offer some thoughts about what CEOs should perhaps do in the future. In some ways, this is a book of essays, but there is a train of thought that ties them all together, and it goes somewhat like this. Global CEOs are in the middle of the third industrial revolution, and they face three kinds of challenges. First, they have their hands full with the central strategic problems of how to take advantage of the internet and the global economy. Second, they face certain everyday dilemmas of leading and managing corporate Goliaths. And third, they have their roles to play on the world political, economic, and social stage. While the strategic and everyday problems are almost overwhelming in themselves, CEOs are doing the best that they can be expected, often against trends and pressures that are much more powerful than they are. That notwithstanding, where they fall down is the third category. They have not sufficiently understood or accepted their roles as leaders in helping to create the rules and institutions for trade, finance, and communications, and for defining social responsibilities for global companies. I am not naive. However, I acknowledge that because the business pressures alone are so awesome, it simply may not be possible for global CEOs to add to what they are doing by substantially expanding their service to society more generally. If this is true, however, we will be worse off. New Haven, Connecticut, November 2000. Chapter 1, Masters of the Universe, or Lost in Space. Leonard Riggio, chairman and CEO of Barnes & Noble, was talking fast and his entire compact body seemed to be in a state of animation. We were discussing the business climate and how it was changing. Put it this way, he said, everything is in play. With these four words, he captured the environment in which CEOs operate today and will operate into the 21st century, the possibilities, the vulnerabilities, the uncertainties. Riggio caught, too, the tension between the various jobs that chief executives have to perform as they scramble to lead their companies and as they come to grips with their changing positions in society. This tension will shape the third industrial revolution that we are all living through today. How do the requirements of running a highly competitive and profitable company interact with other pressures on CEOs to build a better global society? One answer is that they really don't. Business executives worry about shareholders, they worry about customers, and they worry about employees, while governments and public interest groups deal with the rest of us. But this response is far too simplistic. In the real world, CEOs, particularly the kind interviewed for this book, are required to play roles beyond the narrow scope of their businesses, if for no other reason than their companies affect the lives of so many people and communities around the world. But how far does this role extend? How far should it extend? The best starting point for this discussion is something that two CEOs from different countries and industries told me at one time. Unless you are competitive, said Michael Armstrong, chairman and CEO of AT&T, then all other issues are moot. Or as Jorgsen Schrismap, chairman of Daimler Chrysler, put it, only a profitable corporation can think about being a social enterprise. Without underestimating the formidable obstacles CEOs face in the 21st century in running successful companies, I will nevertheless argue for a broader conception of business leadership than now exists in the minds of most top executives. While they are naturally riveted on meeting quarterly earnings targets, and while unrelenting attention to shareholders is the best market discipline that anyone has yet conceived of, most top executives still construe their jobs far too narrowly. Their critical task is to build value for shareholders over time, not just to please speculators and day traders who buy and sell securities according to the latest headlines. This means that CEOs will not only have to run profitable companies, but they will need to build great institutions that provide customers with superior products and services and provide high-quality jobs, and in the process make life better for the population at large. They will also have to devote far more effort to helping to devise rules under the 21st century trade, finance, and communication system, and to lend a hand in building the institutions that will be the global counterpart to the arrangements on which national economies rest. We will continue looking at this very interesting book in future shows, so please stay tuned.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby. And Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
Listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM. You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.